When I first started writing, I had a feeling my mother broke into a silent panic. Her great fear, I thought, was that I'd write something unflattering about the family. But lucky for her, I can't find myself to do that. I've absolutely written about feelings I've had as a child, teenager, or adult. That's essentially all I ever write about. Traumas I need help recovering from, approached obliquely. But I've never directly written about my family the way other writers have in crafting their great, sprawling, epic family plays. It's not because I don't want to or haven't tried. My struggle to lay bare all the truth about my family is that it's all sort of boring. We weren't Rockefellers or coal miners. We have no scandals or crimes in our past. I come from a line of people who delivered mail, sold insurance, answered telephones, sold cars. They'd work all day and then otherwise relax. We've never been a vocal or active people. There were plenty of divorces and broken homes, but those breaks became patched with step-parents who they themselves descended from a similar working families. The challenge, in essence, has been deriving drama from a family world that inherently lacks in drama. Lacking drama to the point where we even tended not to argue. When the family gets mad, the family gets silent. Essentially, the privilege of my life has been the disadvantage of my writing. In recent years, though, things have started to shift. Members of my family, myself included, have realized trajectories in different directions. I began developing a deeper sense of my family's particular pathos. I learned sometimes the truth isn't always the truth, that who we were is not always who we will be. I learned that it's awfully difficult to see it when you're inside it, the forest through the trees, as they say. So now I'm getting a handle on this elusive aspect of my life. The thing that always seems so basic and beige is revealing itself to be colorfully complicated. And lo and behold, I'm seeing the play that yearns to be written. But instead of a sense of relief or excitement for the opportunity to add to the grand tradition of American family plays, I feel an intense amount of dread. Because I'm scared to death to write it. This is American Theater Magazine's The Subtext, and I am Brian James Polak. The Subtext is a podcast where each month this playwright talks to another playwright about what's really going on. On this episode, I have a conversation with Rebecca Gilman, a Chicago-based playwright, award-winning author of more plays than I can name, Pulitzer Prize finalist, teacher, and associate artist with the Goodman Theater. Basically, she's a legend, and I'm a lucky playwright to have had the chance to spend a little time with her. While you're listening to our conversation, take a moment to click a few buttons on your computer or your phone to leave us a rating and comment on the show. I appreciate those of you who have done it already. It's such a big help in getting us to the appropriate playwright-interested ears. If you're on the Twitters, you can find us at Subtext Podcast. And if you ever have the motivation to say something in an email, send it to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. Rebecca Gilman is the recipient of so many awards. I'm going to name a few because they deserve mention. A Guggenheim Fellowship, the Harold and Mimi Steinberg American Theater Critics Association New Play Award, the Harper Lee Award, the Scott McPherson Award, the Prince Prize for Commissioning New Work, the Roger L. Stevens Award from the Kennedy Center Fund for New American Plays, the Evening Standard Award for Most Promising Playwright, and so many more. Her play Boy Gets Girl received an Olivier nomination for Best New Play. She was named a finalist for the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for The Glory of Living. She is a member of the Council of the Dramatists Guild of America and a board member of the ACLU of Illinois. A graduate of the MFA in Playwriting program from the University of Iowa, she is now a professor of playwriting and screenwriting at Northwestern University. And in 2016, she was inducted into the Alabama Writers Hall of Fame. How cool is that? Here's my conversation with Rebecca Gilman, who, I have to note, was a humongous trooper for battling through a cold when she could have canceled on me, but she didn't. And I so appreciate her for that. Before I hit record, you asked me why I moved here. I'm curious what motivated you to move to Chicago originally.
Well, I went to a graduate school at the University of Iowa, and I had never lived in a big city before, and I think it was a choice at that point between moving to Chicago and moving to New York, and Chicago was closer, and you could drive here on the interstate. And
it was just convenience.
It was convenience.
Yeah.
But I already had, there were a lot of people I went to school with in Iowa who'd already moved here. So I knew people here who were already doing theater, and that made it feel accessible to me.
Like the city was already demystified for you a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And then after I moved here, I kept toying with moving to New York, but then it never happened. And so it seems like it's been a good place for me to be.
So you've been here straight through this entire time?
Yeah. Yeah. I moved here, the Major League Baseball was on strike the summer I moved here,
yeah.
Which was disappointing. I wanted to go see the Cubs. But then the next year, they started playing again, and everyone was mad at them, and nobody went, so you could get in really easily, and it was really cheap. So I had this completely false sense of how cheap and easy it was to go see a baseball game, but it was great.
Did you grew up in Alabama, right?
I did, yeah.
Was your entire childhood there?
It was. I went to school in Vermont for a couple of years, but then I moved back to Alabama and I graduated from Birmingham Southern College, which is a little school in Birmingham, Alabama. So until I went to graduate school, I was in Alabama. Yeah.
What was there a moment where theater was first introduced to your life in Alabama?
That's a good question. I grew up in a really little town, and there wasn't any real theater. My parents belonged to the Jewish Community Center in Birmingham, and they did plays, and those were the only plays I really saw growing up. My mom would take me to see plays at JCC, and I saw South Pacific. I saw an Israel Horowitz play, which I don't really remember, except I remember it was really inappropriate, and I probably shouldn't have been there. And I think we saw The King and I there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big deal for me. And then I had a really great teacher in high school who had gone to New York and studied at the Stella Adler Studio to be an actor. And she came back to Birmingham and she taught a class called Topics in Drama. So I took that when I was in high school. And that's when I first started writing plays or skits, basically. And then when I was a freshman in college, I read a little article in Parade magazine that came with the Sunday paper.
Right, yeah, I remember.
That told about the Young Playwrights Festival that the Dramatists Guild sponsored in New York. And they said if you wrote a play and sent it in, you could get a critique from a New York theater professional. And I thought that I wanted a critique. So I wrote a play and sent it in, and it ended up getting chosen for the festival.
Yeah.
So that's when I started writing plays for real, I guess. So I was 18. I just made the cutoff. You had to be 18 or younger to submit.
Right.
So I just barely made it.
So when you were a child going to these shows at the JCC, were you inspired by them? I mean, like, how did they make you feel at the time? Did you think that's a thing I want to do? Or was it just another form of entertainment?
You know, I don't think it was a thing I thought I wanted to do, and I definitely did not know anybody who worked in the theater or made a living from the theater. Mm. So I didn't know that that was a thing that you could do for a living. But I really enjoyed the writing the skits in high school, and they really were skits.
Mm-hmm.
But I really did enjoy doing that. And then once I had the play in the Young Playwrights Festival, that was the first time I like heard something in front of an audience. And that was looking back, it was a ridiculously over the top first experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because the festival really was very well supported by the Dramatists Guild, and like Stephen Sondheim came to my reading, and then Stephen Sondheim gave me a ride back.
What?
Yeah. So
wait, how did what?
I was. They called. They called my home phone number to tell me that they'd picked my play, and my mom answered the phone, and they said she's won this contest and she will be going to New York for her play, and it was at the Public Theater too, so which I did, you know, at the time I didn't know how heavy I knew
right,
what that was.
Right.
But my mom was so worried about my going to New York City by myself. She was scared. So she said to them, please find her. Please find her a safe place to stay. She was really worried.
Right.
So they put me up in Mary Rogers. I stayed with Mary, you know, Richard Rogers' daughter, Mary Rogers. I stayed at her apartment in what I now realize was Adam Gettle's room. I think he was off at college, and I stayed in his room. So there, I had this sort of ridiculously, you know, unrealistic first New York City experience.
Oh, so you're...
Even to the point that I was like, somebody from, I think it was, I can't remember, it was Jeffrey Sweet, I think, was my mentor, and he came over to the apartment to talk to me about my play, and I remember his looking around and saying to me, like, you know, this is not how most people live in New York. This is not a typical New York apartment. It was on Central Park West. It was huge. It was beautiful.
God. So your mom... basically said, I need my daughter taken care of by legendary theater makers while yeah. she's there. Otherwise, I will not feel safe.
She just basically didn't want me, you know, in a flop house or in the Bowery or
right.
something. I don't know why. I didn't know what she thought they were going to do with me. And then Mary Rogers and Stephen Sondheim were friends. And then after the reading, he gave us a ride back up to her apartment in his car. He wasn't driving. He
right.
had a driver, of course.
Right.
All of it was... yeah, it was. Let's just say that was a high point that never really was reached again in my career. So,
I mean, were you aware? Like, how much were you aware of while this was happening?
I knew who all those people were, so it wasn't. I wasn't an idiot. But I did remember thinking like, oh, this is what it is to be a playwright, and I was wrong. But it was great. It was a great experience.
Can you recall anything, any interactions you had with Stephen Sondheim?
I remember he told me he liked the title of my play. That's all I remember. And I thought, that's really nice.
What was the title? Do you remember?
It was called Always Open.
Always Open.
Because it took place in a Denny's restaurant,
mm-hmm.
which they're always open. So,
did you consider, after this experience, this amazing experience, and this is your first play,
mm-hmm.
did you, after this, think, hey, I guess I'm a playwright now?
I didn't, because I didn't really know what a playwright was. I mean, I just didn't know anybody who actually did it for a living. And I kind of still don't. But but then I did really enjoy it, and I thought I want to keep doing this. I didn't know how you pursued it, really. And when I went back to college in Birmingham, I was really lucky. It was a really small college, and I got a lot of attention. And I wrote a play there. Again, I had bad motivations, though. I needed an extra credit to graduate, and so I wrote a play for an independent study so uh-huh. I could graduate. But then my professors were super nice, and they liked it, and they let me have the theater for the summer, you know, in the theater department to produce it, and so I did with my friends. And that's when I think I thought, oh, this is what I want to do for real, because I enjoyed that experience so much.
What were you writing about at the time?
Always Open was about these people who work at a Krispy Kreme donut shop who kill their manager, and because they hate him. But they hang out in the Denny's, and then they plot to kill the manager, and then one of them goes over and actually kills him, and then everybody's stuck feeling culpable because they were. I wrote about like ethical issues and problems. Like the idea behind that was bearing witness, that you can't just stand by and watch something happen. You know, if you're passive, you're complicit in an unethical act. And the other one was called The Land of Little Horses, and it was more of a family drama. That's when I wrote my play about my parents, I guess, my family. And then after that, I started writing about other things. So yeah.
Did your parents see the play about your family?
Yeah, they did.
Did they connect to it? Did they think it, did they see themselves in it?
Well, the father character was dead in it. And I remember my cousin saying to my dad, because my whole family came to see it. I remember my cousin saying to my dad, she said, Steve, you're so lucky she killed you off before it started. So yeah, they knew, I think. Yeah.
I know my mom has always been afraid of me writing about her ever since I became a writer. She's sort of just like waiting for it. When's the play about me going to happen? Like, she has to take her lumps, I would guess.
It's funny because sometimes you write about people and it's really obvious to you that you're writing about them and they don't see themselves at all. And other times they see themselves in characters that are in no way intended to be them. I don't think you can ever really win, so you may as well just go ahead and do it.
Write what you want to write, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in a particularly artistic household? I know you said your mom took you to see theater, but was anybody else in your family particularly artistically engaged?
No, I mean, they had other pursuits, but no, you know, my dad was a bookkeeper, my mom was a secretary, and nobody was artistic. I'm the artistic one.
Were they supportive of your, you know, your choices as you were, you know, going through school?
They were, yeah. Again, nobody thought that it was anything that you would pursue as a career or that you could make a living at.
Right.
I ended up being an English major. That was like some practical consideration because I thought I would become an English professor. That was sort of the thing I thought I would do, is be a professor and then maybe write plays in my spare time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, isn't all together different from what's going on, right?
No, like, I mean, I made a career as a playwright, and then I started teaching at Northwestern, where I teach now. But it did sort of end up that way, but it didn't go in the direction I thought it would go. I actually became a playwright first, and then a professor.
So after you had these first experiences, the young playwright's experience and hanging out with Sondheim and finishing school.
Which we still do to this day. Yeah. No, yeah. Sorry. No.
You reminisce about that car ride.
Yeah, we just talk about that one car ride and how great it was. Yeah.
I just imagine the same. It's like a Groundhog Day thing, except you're both aging instead. And all he talks about is the title of your play.
Yeah. Over and over again.
So when did you sort of like, I don't know, maybe I'm phrasing it incorrectly, but when did you sort of just decide this is my path that I'm going to take? I'm going to be a playwright.
I didn't, you know, I went to graduate school at Iowa, and that was a 3-year MFA program. And even then, I didn't become a playwright. Even then, I got a job in like educational testing after that, and I don't know why, because I just did. And then it wasn't until I'd been in Chicago for a while, maybe over a year, that a very good friend, who's now my husband, actually looked at me and said, "Why don't you quit this dumb day job and try to be a playwright? Like, just be a playwright. Just try to write plays and do that full time." And that was when I finally did it.
But how do you sustain yourself? And
I worked as a temp, which was a much better deal than having a real job. And I always tell my students that, and they always looked really scared, and I'm sure their parents would hate me for saying it. But if you have a real job, you have a real job. But if you have a job that just pays you and you it's not consuming you, you know, I think that's the better way to go. So I worked as a temp for KPMG, a giant accounting firm, for a while. And then, you know, I had a show here in Chicago that went well, and the Goodman gave me a commission after that. And that was when I thought, oh, okay, now I guess I'm a playwright.
So how long after you moved here did that happen?
It was a while. It was five years maybe. I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was because it was probably 1999, I think. Yeah.
So there was some struggle in there.
Yeah, there was. And there was a lot of doing, you know, luckily, like I said, I had friends here who were doing theater. So there was a lot of, like, doing shows in the back rooms of bars and stuff. But that's what Chicago is. It's great about Chicago. You can do stuff here cheaply and it's accessible, and people do come see things. So it was bad, but it was also fun. I mean, I was broke, but it was fun. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't soul crushing or anything.
Right.
Because a lot of people were doing what I was doing, so.
Right. And did you have a cadre of people? Were you amongst others working on plays?
Yeah, I was really lucky. But, you know, somebody I met at Iowa was Brett Nevue, and we've been mm-hmm. friends for 30 years now. And so Brett and I did, like, puppet plays and a bunch of doofy stuff together. And he had a kind of cruddy job at the same time I had a cruddy job, and we would meet for lunch every week and sort of commiserate about things. And then I applied to Chicago Dramatists to become a resident playwright there, and I was accepted, and that was a big deal. That's when I met a whole bunch of people who mm-hmm. became friends, and that was a great support system there.
What was the play that you feel like sort of broke you? Because you mentioned you had a play that went well, and then the Goodman gave you a commission.
It was The Glory of Living, which was premiered at Circle Theater in Forest Park, which is a suburb of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But it went really well and got a lot of critical attention. And so I went from that to a commission from the Goodman, which is not a normal trajectory, but... yeah, that was basically it.
How'd that make you feel? Like, can you remember back then?
Oh yeah, it was great because I had quit my job at KPMG. Let me think of the time. Oh, I remember I was at KPMG. And Susan Booth was the director of New Play Development at the Goodman, and she had been given my play, The Glory of Living, by Russ Tuttero, who ran Chicago Dramatists. And this is the other great thing about Chicago, too, is people, I think, you know, really try to help people out when they're getting started.
Yeah.
And Russ would send our plays all over the place, and people would actually read them. You know, it was nice. I didn't have an agent or anything, so he sent that play to Susan. And she called me and said, please come and have a meeting with me. I want to talk to you about your play. And she was really helpful. And she was trying to essentially tell me how to be a playwright. Like, I needed to get an agent. I needed to do all these things. And I didn't. And she just said all these people's names, and I didn't know who the F she was talking about. And I just sat there for so long. And then finally, probably like, you know, 30 or 40 minutes into the meeting, I said, can I write some of this down? I just didn't know. I just was pretending the entire right. time that I knew what she was right. talking about. But she was really patient with me, and she really helped me out. And she had given the play to Bob Falls, and he had really liked it. And then after... it opened, you know, and it did really well, and people from the Goodman went to see it, and then they offered me a commission after that.
And what did that commission become?
That was Spinning into Butter.
That became Spinning into Butter.
Yeah.
A play that I love.
Oh, thank you.
I really do love that. That was my introduction to you as a playwright years ago. I was given a reading list of plays when I first started writing, and Spinning into Butter was on that list. So when it was actually one of the first plays, period, that I had read.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is a long time coming,
yes.
having this conversation with you.
Back in the dark ages.
Right. Well, yeah. I had a few months ago, I interviewed Paula Vogel, and How I Learned to Drive was also on that list. So doing this podcast is kind of like I'm connecting with like my initial heroes of playwriting. And I feel so fortunate to be able to do that.
Well, we're lucky to have you talk to us. No, it is. It's very nice.
Every time I just read a description of a play that you're writing, I think, oh, that's a brilliant idea for a play. And as a playwright myself, I know that it's the stupidest question that we get. Where do your ideas come from? But I'm trying to sort of like find my way into your brain a little bit to sort of get an idea of what's inspiring you. Because in what I imagine is you read every single newspaper in America, right? And then and you cut out these news stories that may not be getting the attention, the national attention that they should have. And when one, they slowly fall off the wall, and the one that ends up staying longest is the one you end up writing. How close am I?
You're pretty close. I still get an actual physical newspaper, and I do cut things out, and I do put them in a file. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I'm, like, riffing here.
That's what I do. Yeah. And it usually is something that's buried, you know, pretty, you know, page 8 or 9 or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I look for things that that bother me or piss me off usually.
Yeah.
I don't read every newspaper in the country. I will say that. I only
they're mailed to your house every morning.
That's not happening.
Yeah.
It's funny too. I've always an assignment I give my playwriting students that I've always given is to find a newspaper story and write a 10-minute play from the story. And it's one that was given to me when I was a playwriting student. And it used to be, I don't do it anymore because no one reads the physical paper anymore.
Right.
Because the whole point was that you were just supposed to sit there and turn the pages and see what jumped out at you, what piqued your interest.
Yeah.
And now they just go online and they generally start with an idea and then go online to find a story that will allow them to write the play that they wanted to write is what I found. It's just a whole different experience. That's an aside, but...
But it is an interesting... It is interesting to sort of unpack the way people, or diagnose, I don't know the proper word, the way people find their inspirations.
Yeah.
I was just listening to an episode of Radiolab, which is a podcast where I find a ton of inspiration. So one of the Radiolab producers, his name is Latif Nasser, was talking about they were talking about him as one of the producers on their podcast who finds the most, not off the wall, but off the road stories to do. And he talked about one of the ways that he does it is by going to the Wikipedia homepage. And on the left side of the screen, there is a button you can click that says random. And he will click random and he will see what pops up. And it could be, you know, a biography of a person, a painter you've never heard of. And he will read that, and maybe it will take him into a rabbit hole and a hyperlink to something else. But maybe he'll then go to another random. And he will just keep randomly hitting these web pages until some story pops up that really captures his attention. And then he turns it into a pitch, and it becomes a story on their show.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have to investigate why it interests you. Like, what was it that made you stop and look at it? And what does it speak to? And does it remind you of something more personal or something that's already been on your mind? And I do find I think about things for a really long time before I sit down and start it. But sometimes things just fall in your lap, too. You see something on the street, or I think I used to be more methodical, and now I'm not. Now I'm just sort of like, oh, there's an idea. But if I also used to try to force things, and I don't do that so much anymore. I think when you're younger, I'm going to be the old lady here for a second, but I think when you're younger, you feel like you have to be producing things constantly. Or I felt that way. And now I feel like a patience about just letting something hit me when it hits me and then starting from there and not forcing it. I used to really agonize over things when I was writing on something and it wasn't going well. And now I essentially am much more patient with myself, and I'm actually writing more efficiently that way too. So it's
do you
weird.
Feel as it? Do you feel like you need to have some kind of personal connection or from some kind of personal emotional connection to the thing that you're writing?
I do. And like I said, a lot of the stories that I would that I cut out piss me off. That's just part of where I start.
That's the starting point.
Yeah.
But does it go beyond that? Like, do you find yourself in your work at all?
Yeah. And I try to, you know, I often, the stories that jump out at me are about people who remind me of the people I grew up with or people that I know well too. So I don't think I would pick a story from some sphere that I'm not familiar with,
mm-hmm.
or that I don't have a connection to. So I'm not going to write about something that might be fascinating about people in Turkey or something, for example. And I really am drawn to that and I empathize or something, but I'm not going to try to write a play about it. I don't know why I picked Turkey, but
right.
Just, you know.
Right. Well, it's just the idea of how was it described to me? The bad way to say it is staying in your lane,
mm-hmm.
right? What's the more articulate way to say that? I have been told to stay in my lane directly,
uh-huh.
in that language.
Uh-huh. And that's a tricky one, because I think that when I was writing, the whole idea, I always think about, there's that line in To Kill a Mockingbird where she says, you know, you have to, she says it two different ways in the Horton Foote screenplay. I can't remember how she says it in the book. But she says once, you know, that Atticus tells Scout that she needs to get in somebody else's shoes and walk around for a little bit. And then later she says you need to crawl inside somebody's skin and walk around for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when I was starting out as a writer, that was sort of the goal, was to try to live other people's experiences and understand it and present it in a way that would get an audience to think about a story that they wouldn't normally have thought about. But now I think we're in an age where that could veer into cultural appropriation and people get worried or scared, or they don't feel like it's a legitimate thing to do anymore. And that's a conversation that's ongoing and needs to be had. But makes it difficult then for people to have some sort of imaginative leap or empathy with people who are not like themselves, which is part of why you do become an artist. So I feel like a lot of people right now are feeling kind of stuck.
It's like it is that feeling of being stuck and kind of walking on eggshells a little bit and being afraid to share the idea, because it's, you know, you're inspired and you're moved and you're emotionally connected to it, you're invested in this story, you feel like you have to tell it because nobody else is telling it at the moment, but is it your story to tell?
Yeah, it's a hard one, I think. And I find that, you know, I grew up in a small town, and I've lived in a big city for a while, so I find even now, like, well, you know, can I, writing about a rural experience or a small town experience, I think people who don't know me think that I don't have the authority, or it's not legitimate for me to write about some of the characters that I write about. And I sort of want to, you know, pull out my, you know, down home credentials every once in a while and go, mm-hmm. it is, I think I can write about this. But yeah, it's the thing that I guess that troubles me about it is that artists, I'm worried that we're engaging in, a horizontal hostility, that we're fighting with each other rather than focusing our resistance or our anger or our energy towards the appropriate targets right now, which, you know, we need to be fighting up the pyramid, I think, rather than yelling at each other. So that's when I get worried, is I feel like, you know, are the people who are really in charge pitting us against one another in a way that's not good for the form or good for us as even a culture or a society. So that's one of the things I worry about.
Mm-hmm. Playwright on playwright violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is ugly because we're really bad actually at fighting. So yeah. It's just kind of clumsy.
Yeah, but yeah. We're good at slinging words yeah. to each other, aren't we? And with social media now, you see those words flying around.
Yeah, which is why I don't engage with that at all. So, yay!
So great. So smart. Does small town Alabama life rear its head in your work?
I haven't written anything set in the South in a long time. The most recent piece I did that was set in the South was an adaptation of a Tennessee Williams short story that I did for the acting company a while back that was set in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Mostly that's because I haven't lived there in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I also found that it's hard to write about the South without people bringing their preconceptions or stereotypical ideas about what Southerners are like to the plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of stopped, mm-hmm. honestly. I got a little bit tired of... It seemed like the plays that were successful that were about the South portrayed people in ways that I found cartoonish. And the plays I was writing didn't seem to ring true for people who didn't actually know what the South was. So, mm-hmm. But I've just lived mm-hmm. in the Midwest forever, and that's sort of what I hear now when I hear people talk.
Well, I would actually, I'm relatively new to the Midwest, and I've spent, you know, a minute living in the South in my past. But I have noticed a lot of crossover between Midwestern life and Southern life in the speed at which people live,
mm-hmm.
and the focus on home life more so than outside life that mm-hmm. I've experienced living in, you know, big cities yeah. around the country.
I think it's a larger, you know, everyone keeps talking about the urban-rural divide. And this is another instance of our being pitted against each other, mm-hmm. you know, in a mm-hmm. way that is only profiting a few people, which is really unfortunate. I can't even make that big of a generalization. It's funny to me. I really love... I really actually feel much more at home in a rural environment than I do in the city. I live in the city because I have to, really. I love a lot of things about the city, but a lot of things about it suck. And it's really hard. And I sometimes think that people who live in urban environments have to walk around telling themselves that it's the greatest thing on earth in order to justify the incredible inconvenience and hardship that is their everyday life. The cost of everything and how big a pain in the ass everything is. So you have to walk around going, this is so exciting. This is the greatest thing ever. I'm going to this or I'm going to that. When deep down inside, you know, like, life does not have to be this hard.
I am right there with you. I actually, you know, I grew up in relatively rural New Hampshire, ever since graduating from high school, have lived in a city
mm-hmm.
ever since then. But lately, my dream life is becoming living on a farm with lots of animals
mm-hmm.
and still having the accessibility to the culture of a city and the connectivity of being part of a theater community.
Yeah.
So I want these, but I want my home life to be quiet
yeah.
and land
yeah.
and a cow and some chickens and a goat. Like,
yeah. Everybody's really nature deprived and it's tragic. The thing I love about the city is I love the diversity of the city, and I love, you know, you walk around Chicago and there's people from all over the world here, and that's the one thing I don't want to trade for anything, but there's a whole lot to be said for having a more intimate relationship with the natural world that I think we're all suffering because we don't right now.
Yeah, and as our cities grow, where, you know, the amount of nature shrinks.
Yeah.
Eric Koble wrote a great play about this. He's a Cleveland playwright called My Barking Dog, about the encroachment of nature to city and city to nature. It's kind of amazing. So you talked a while back about how you were sustained, you became a playwright. You had your first commission at the Goodman that became Spinning into Butter, and you were sustaining your life as a playwright for a while. Were you able to do that essentially like you were going like commission to commission, and like how was that manifesting for you?
You know, it was good in a lot of ways, and it was not so good in other ways. I mean, it was great to be actually making my living as a playwright and having that be my primary focus. And the thing was, is that I was making enough money that I could sustain myself pretty well, even though my income had, you know, varied wildly year to year. But like, if I had a good year, I could sock some money away, and then I could sort of keep going. The thing that was starting to wear on me, though, was that it did put a financial pressure on my writing.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the writing wasn't going well, it wasn't just like, oh, the play's not going well. It's like, oh, you know, what am I going to do for money if this doesn't get produced? And I found that I was taking probably more commissions than I should have. Commissions are a blessing and a curse, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I was taking more commissions than I should have, just so that I would know that I have things lined up. But then that becomes a pressure because you're not writing the plays and people are wondering where they are. And when Northwestern started their graduate dramatic writing program, they said, do you want to come talk to us about teaching? And I don't remember who I spoke with there, but one of the people in the faculty who's not my colleague. I can't remember her name. You're going to have to edit this out. Anyway, someone I talked to on the faculty at Northwestern was saying that the thing she loved about teaching was that if her writing wasn't going well, she could sort of shift her focus onto creating a really great class and the work that her students were doing and helping her students. And I thought, well, that's actually what I need, because when my writing isn't going well, I'm just freaking out. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting at home by myself freaking out. And I need to be able to think about somebody else and what somebody else needs from me, and how can I make this my class, or, you know, my teaching a good experience for my students. And that's been the balance that I've found that has been really, I think, really mentally and financially and artistically helpful for me. And, you know, also I have benefits.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. Just, you know, playwriting is just, there's a reason why so many playwrights go into writing for television and for film. It's just really hard to make a living at it. But if we had, you know, we have the Affordable Care Act now, and I think it's a big deal. I always tell my students this, and they're always looking at me, because I have friends who are theater artists in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Their lives are just so freaking cush. I mean, they have the health care.
Yeah.
They got the free college education. They can go into their little theaters and do their plays and go home, and they don't have to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be theater artists without making a fortune at it and have a good life. So I really feel like if, you know, I remember saying to my students, like, lobby your elected officials for health care. And they would just look at me. I would go, it will mean so much to your writing life and your artistic life if you don't have to worry about those things.
Yeah, and it's so hard. Like that. It's amazing how something that is so far removed from being an artist, that is having health care, is one of the most important things to being an artist.
Yeah.
But when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you're on somebody else's insurance, you've never thought about insurance at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably the first person even mentioning this to your students in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to take 9 other people over the next several years to say something before they're able to connect with it. I mean, now I guess Obamacare has allowed younger people to stay on parental insurance.
Yeah.
If people are so fortunate to have that situation.
Yeah.
Until like 25 or 26, so it kicks the can down the road a little bit.
But it's not the you know, the socialized medicine that other countries enjoy.
Right. I have a Swedish brother-in-law.
Oh, lucky you. Can you marry him and then you could get Swedish citizenship?
Man,
my
sister married him. Sorry. That's what my sister
did.
Did
they adopt you?
And they've had two children and... Oh, I've been so jealous. I wonder what legally, if I have any legal rights.
There has to be some way to finagle that.
It is a bit of a dream because they live outside of, they moved to the United States, but they were living outside of Stockholm and they had a little house and they had now I'm realizing they were living like my idealized world with a little house and some yard with animals.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. You have to learn Swedish, which is really hard.
It is really hard.
Yeah.
But they all speak English.
They all
speak
English too. So. Yeah.
Did you feel, did you ever feel that pull to film and television? I know Spitting Into Butter became a film. But did you ever feel like transitioning?
You know, I never really did. I've done a couple of things when I've been asked to do them, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed them. But I never wanted to move to LA, and it just never really piqued my interest the way writing for the theater did. And I can't say like, oh, I hate it or it's terrible, or you know, I have plenty of friends who work in television and film and they're really happy. Mm-hmm. The only time I've ever really wanted to do it is if I've seen a movie by usually an independent filmmaker who's a writer director. Mm-hmm. And I've thought, wow, if I could do that, like if I could realize a vision from beginning to end,
right.
That's the one thing I would want to do. That's the only time I've really thought about it.
How did the film of Spitting Into Butter come about?
It came about through a producer named Norman Twain, who has passed away, but he saw the play and really liked it and optioned it. And then, like with everything, you know, you have to find a star now, but Sarah Jessica Parker had actually gone to see it too, and it was at Lincoln Center and liked the play, and she wanted to play the part. So it really came about through her efforts. And then Mark Brokaw, who's a wonderful theater director, directed the film. But it was a weird process. I've never, you know, done anything like it. And you don't know until you're in it. You're like, oh, unlike playwriting, you can rewrite everything I wrote. I don't really have the control. It's shocking if you're not prepared for it.
I mean, did you learn that when you saw the final cut? Or what was your involvement in the process?
I started a screenplay. They brought two or three other people on who worked on it. I worked on it again. Everyone was very respectful and accommodating towards me, and that was all good. But I'd never... had I known more, too, I think it could have been a better screenplay. I didn't know anything about screenwriting, really, mm-hmm. and I didn't know that much about structure. Things that I know now, I can look at it and I can go like, oh, I could fix that. That could be better. But a lot of what happens during filming and editing and is out of your control. So it was a good experience in that everyone I worked with was terrific and I really liked working with them, but I'm not sitting around watching the movie, honestly. Yeah. It's a little hard for me to watch.
I mean, from my perspective, it's a miracle that it got made because I know that, like, plays are getting optioned constantly. And the small amount I know after living in Los Angeles for a bit of time, any film getting made is a miracle.
Yeah.
So to see one actually fully realized is probably wonderful and then painful when you see that it is not a play. It is not your play anymore.
Yeah, and there's some things about it I think are good in terms of having made it more cinematic, actually. But the one thing that's I'm not going to complain about is it does pay a lot better than the playwriting. So I'm not going to complain loudly about that at all. That's a good thing.
So you've been teaching at Northwestern for a while. Did that, well, I'm going to go back actually. So when you talked about how they invited you to come in and start teaching, had you taught at all before
I had taught at a community college in Iowa. I taught basic comp for a while, but I'd also done some sort of longer, like, guest artist gigs, too.
So did you have some feeling of, like, you know, an innate ability to stand up in a classroom and communicate thoughts to students?
I hope so. It is a learning curve. You know, I feel like I've gotten better at it as the years have gone by. And I did say, I thought, well, you know, I hope they like me and they want to keep me. And I thought I would try it for a year, and I'm in my 13th year. So obviously it worked out. Yeah. I have really amazing colleagues. So that's been one of the nicest things about it.
How did it impact your writing? You know, you're no longer, you know, pulling your hair out all day long because you have other responsibilities.
There's that, and I've also just become a lot more efficient because I know I have, you know, X amount of time to get my writing done. So when I'm in a quarter in which I'm teaching, I usually set aside one day and I make sure nothing can happen on that day and I can write on that day. And then my summers are sacred too.
Mm-hmm.
People are always like, "Oh, come see us over the summer." I'm like, "No." But that's really when I have time to get something done. And I'm insanely lucky because I have this wonderful relationship with the Goodman. So right now, for example, you know, I teach tomorrow. I was in rehearsal today.
Mm-hmm.
I can do everything I want and need to do here. And it's been great. I feel super lucky.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that is one of the gifts that a lot of playwrights have, an artistic home. And it seems like very early on, the Goodman opened their arms to you and never let go.
Yeah, and I didn't let go of them either. I had, you know, Spitting Into Butter did well, and then I got another commission, and that was Boy Gets Girl. And then And then after that, I started working with Bob. Bob directed my third play here, which was Blue Surge. And we just really hit it off in the terms of collaborating. And also, we just hit it off. We have a lot in common. And the thing that I think is great about the Goodman that is not true of every other theater is, you know, I've had a couple of plays here that were ginormous flops, just did not do well at all. And I think a lesser theater might say, all right, that's it, you're out of here. But the Goodman doesn't do that. I think the Goodman invests in the artist it believes in for the long haul. And that's part of what I've always felt here. And, you know, it was actually after my biggest flop that they asked me to become an artistic associate. At the time when most people probably thought, like, oh, they're going to get rid of her. That was when they actually asked me to come on board even more.
Yeah.
So it's just been...
I mean, at the time, did you feel anxiety? Do you feel responsible if that happens? Like, the play isn't selling well?
I felt terrible. I remember, it was a true history of the Johnstown flood. Everyone will know what I'm talking about. And I wrote Rock Schulfer an email apologizing. I was like, I'm really sorry. I want my plays to do well for you. And I know that this one did not do well for you at all. I mean, I did. I felt very responsible.
Yeah.
And he wrote me the most lovely email back. This is the thing. He said because we're both baseball fans.
Yeah.
He said, you know, you swung for the fence and didn't quite make it out, but you swung for the fence.
Right.
And I remember thinking, that's so sweet. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he admired the risk that I took.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sort of politely acknowledged, yeah, okay, maybe.
Yeah, and people really didn't like it. But yeah.
I really have a hard time wrapping my head around monetizing what we do and using that as the measure of success. You know, if it earned a lot of money, it's good.
Yeah.
And if it didn't, it's not good. And
well, this was a commercial and critical flop. So it was a flop across the board.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't just that no one wanted to see it. They didn't want to see it because everyone thought it was terrible.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's lovely that they said, you know what? fine.
Yeah.
Shit happens. Join us even deeper on a deeper level.
Yeah.
What does that mean to be an artistic? Is it just sort of like a title on paper, or do you get keys?
I have a key fob, which is a big
deal. Oh, really?
I can come in and out of this building anytime I want. I don't actually know if that's true. Probably, probably at like 3 a.m, I couldn't get in. But and I have essentially, it's like a rolling commission. That's essentially what it is.
Okay.
Essentially, right. Like I have an open rolling commission.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get invited to parties. And on a more serious note, I'm sometimes asked to help make artistic decisions, which is nice.
Yeah.
Not on anybody else's work, but just sort of the mission
right.
of the theater in general and what's going on.
Right. That's nice because it's sort of honoring your experience, the amount of time you've been here and what you've witnessed as a writer and as an observer of what's going on here. I mean, that's just smart business. I think. So we have a few minutes left.
Okay.
Let's talk about Twilight Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
What newspaper did that one crawl out of?
That one didn't come out of a newspaper. This was a commission from the Big Ten Consortium of Schools, the theater departments at the Big, or if you're a sports fan, NCAA Sports.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and I think there's 13 schools in the Big Ten now. But, you know, like Iowa, Northwestern, Wisconsin, Ohio, Purdue,
Ohio State, Michigan.
Yeah. Rutgers, Maryland. Those are the outliers. Why? But anyway, they were recent additions, I guess. But anyway, all the theater departments, you know, their students, their actors are mostly women, but they don't have a lot of good plays for women of that age with significant roles. So they pooled their resources and they started commissioning playwrights to write plays for young women in their 20s. And so they approached me to do this. And the only requirement was it needed to have 6 significant roles.
Mm-hmm.
Which at first I thought, oh, no problem. And then when I started thinking about it, I was like, ouch. But I started thinking about it, and I wanted to write about basically the characters are people I grew up with, only it's set in Wisconsin. It's not set in Alabama, but they're people I grew up with and sort of the ways in which your own decisions or life can take you on different courses, different trajectories. And I'm really concerned at this point in my life with, you know, what is success and how do we define success?
Yeah.
And I think we have really narrow definitions of success in our country. And I think they're ultimately really destructive and they don't allow people to sort of live outside of commercialized norms. And, you know, so that if you're not doing something that pays a lot of money or gets a lot of attention, you're a failure. And I just think that's a really toxic way to live. So I tried to look at these young women and how they navigated through the world. And I also kept thinking about what is it to grow up as a woman in this country and what sorts of obstacles are put in your way and what sort of options or decisions are actually closed off to you before you even start.
Yeah.
So that's part of what I'm looking at too.
How would you articulate success?
Success is being happy at whatever you choose to do, essentially, I think. I don't know. You know, I'm afraid that there's so much emphasis right now on getting attention, beating somebody else, you know, the sort of careerism that a lot of even people in the arts have become engaged in. And I'm like, you know, if you want to go live in an off-the-grid house in the middle of a field and you're happy. That's success to me. It's whatever it is you want to do. But I think that part of that, you know, rural-urban divide I was talking about earlier comes from people shaming each other into thinking that they're failures when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's bad for everybody. So that's part of what I'm looking at in the play, because there is a, it takes place in Wisconsin, but there's a character who sort of comes into this, it takes place in a bowling alley, who comes into this bowling alley who's not from the small town, and they all make each other feel badly about themselves, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I keep coming back to this, like, you know, whenever we're fighting each other, we're not fighting the people who are exploiting us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's so much in our world right now that is working really hard to mystify us and confuse us so that we, I'm going to get all Marxist here, so that we don't, you know, band together and overthrow the people who are exploiting us.
Mm-hmm.
And make this a more fair and just world to live in.
Yeah.
And so I think it happens in just about every setting and every part of the world. So that's part of what I'm looking at.
Would you say you're successful?
I'm very happy where I am now. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, although I'm sure there are people who would think, you know, by some measure, I'm not as successful as somebody else. But I always say this to my students. I think, especially when you're starting out, you're like, oh, this person got this commission, or this person got this production, or this person got this thing. And I'm like, you cannot measure yourself and your success by other people. And I always say, you got to keep your eyes on your own page.
Mm-hmm.
And do what it is you want to do. Say what you want to say the best way you can say it. And don't worry about anything else. And that's why I feel like, things, you know, I don't want, you know, I'm superstitious, so I need to knock wood, but I feel successful now, and then that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as that continues, I think, yeah, everything's going to be okay.
Right on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was awesome talking to you.
You too, as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rebecca Gilman. Thank you to the Goodman, especially Ramsey Carey, for organizing this conversation. Rebecca's play Twilight Bowl is playing now through March 10th at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. Go to thegoodmantheater.org for information and tickets and all that. If you liked this conversation, don't hesitate to share with all your friends and people in your life. The music at the beginning of the episode is from David Hillowitz. The music you are hearing right now is from Jan Terrien. The theme song for the subtext is from International Pen Pal. The Subtext is produced, edited, and hosted by yours truly, and presented by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group. Thank you for listening. Here we are again at another end of the episode. The play filling me up this month is God Said This by Leah Nonico Winkler. I saw the production a few months ago when I had the chance to interview Leah for the April 2018 episode of The Subtext. I've been thinking about that play a lot lately because I've been exploring writing about my own family, and also because the play is running right now off-Broadway. If you're in New York, and if it's still running, I hope it is, go see this hilarious, brilliant, and wonderful play. All right, that's it. Take care, everybody.